My name is Dario Hasenstab. I'm here with Walter Hagrids, and we are back with the Western Bubble podcast after a quick 2-week break. Walter, today we're talking about a variety of topics simply because if you do not talk about the world of international relations for 2 weeks, a lot of things happen left, right, and center. So today we'll first talk about my trip to the UK. I have some exciting observations to share with you. Then we have to talk about the Trump madness. And ultimately we'll talk about Eurovision again. As our loyal listeners know, we are both big Eurovision fans.
Hi, Dario. Indeed. And good to have you back. Welcome back in continental Europe. And I look forward to having this conversation with you. That's the good thing about not speaking for a while. Then there's lots of things to discuss.
Indeed. And I mean, I'm actually interested to talk to you about the UK, because for me, it was the first time in the United Kingdom, except a brief layover of 2 hours a year ago. But I've so far, I've managed to avoid the UK, maybe because I'm German. I don't know. So I also had my expectations managed, right? You see a lot of videos coming out of London where there's pickpocketing happening and it seems to be an unpleasant place, and then Brexit on top of it. And you actually studied in the UK for a while. So we have you with a lot of UK experience and me with no UK experience.
Yeah, and in fact, and not just that, my partner is English. So I have a lot of love for the UK, and specifically in my case, England, right? I mean, I've been to Wales and Scotland, but I lived in England for 4 years. And I had an amazing time. It was in the 1990s, so it's a long time ago. But I have a very warm place for England and the UK. Having said that, I've always shared, of course, your skepticism about where the UK is heading. I mean, the 21st century has not been kind to the UK, and the UK has not been kind to Europe. And in that sense, there's a lot to be concerned about. But I'm very eager to find out if your personal experiences kind of mirror my own experiences when I was there. So what did you think? What was it like?
Well, let me start with the stereotypes that everyone kind of has about the UK. And I mean, I always say that I'm a quote unquote fan of stereotypes, because I think it's a great conversation opener. If you meet someone from a new place and you say, oh, sorry, I'm really sorry, I don't know anything about your country except the stereotypes. Why don't you put them into context for me? Right. And then usually you get something in between of, oh, they're super wrong and racist, or, oh, there is some truth to it, right? Such as Germans drinking a lot, right? So that's one of those things that you can get into a nice conversation with. And first of all, British food being bland, I always thought it was a lie. No, it's not. And I thought it was interesting that they don't even put salt and pepper on the table in many places, because it's really humiliating to ask for salt and pepper, right? To sit there and be like, hello, your food is delicious, but I can't taste it. Could you please bring me some salt and pepper? So that I thought was interesting. And I really enjoyed the British politeness. I loved it. I loved the fact that you arrive there and they're just nice. They're just polite. And it's not this white, empty American small talk. It's just, they're generally nice people, particularly the further up north into the country you go, right? So we also spent some time in Scotland, and I was blown away that they called me honey and love and dear all the time. And I felt very, very nice and warm and fuzzy in my stomach.
But this is a known thing, right? So my wife is from Liverpool, and the north is always known to be kind of super friendly and very kind. Generally, British politeness is a real thing, right? And so sometimes stereotypes are based on some kind of true reality, and in this case that's very much so. Having said that, I also find it fascinating that if that is like that, you go north and people are super friendly, super kind, super helpful. How fascinating that it's now the north that forms the basis of the Reform Party of Nigel Farage, which is basically saying F you to the rest of the world, right? So there's almost like a paradox or a conflict between those two realities.
That's exactly what I was hinting at, right? Is I was welcome everywhere. They were, no matter with whom you talked, they were always excited that you were there. I'm asking you, oh, what are you going to visit of my beautiful country? I said, oh, your beautiful country, it's really beautiful. I'm going to go to this and this place. And they were always really excited, giving you tips and tricks on how to get around. And yeah, there seems to be a complete disconnect between that attitude that they have to your face and then the attitude in the voting booth, or potentially even on social media, or maybe I just met the wrong people. And everyone who's kind of voting for reform doesn't even talk to you to begin with. But I didn't have a single negative interaction while traveling. I mean, I seldomly have negative interactions while traveling. I was very pleasantly and positively surprised, and then wondered exactly this. How can it be that these are the people who are so skeptical towards the outsiders?
Well, when you say I've seldom got negative experiences when I travel, it's good to be a white man, Dario. It helps. the reality, I think, is that yes, people are very friendly there, and it's genuine. Look, it's good to remember that the North used to be a labor bulwark, right? The trade unions, very strong there, the mines, industry. And they've shifted to Brexit and to reform simply because for them it's against the establishment, an establishment that has left them behind. A little bit the same reason why so many people vote for Trump. Not because they specifically know much or care much about how reform positions the UK towards the rest of the world, but it's basically saying we do not want establishment politics to continue, right? And I think that's more what's going on. So I don't think it takes away any of their friendliness. At most, there is a certain level of ignorance about what Reform UK actually is promoting, what their agenda is, how they perceive themselves in the rest of the world. Then again, the opinion polls do show very clearly that there are these inherent deep biases and delusions about immigration, right? So if you live in London, you see immigrants all around, but London is the city that's least concerned about immigration because they know that the reality is actually quite interesting. And there are some problems associated to immigration, but there's also loads of benefits to it. Whereas in the North, you're much less likely to have immigrants around you. And so it's much easier to think, oh, they're the ones who are stealing my job. They're the ones who are a problem, because you can fantasize about it. You can create an imaginary world because reality doesn't interfere with that.
Speaking about London and the diversity I experienced in London, I also realized how much easier it is for the United States and the United Kingdom to be countries of immigration. Because having English as your language is just such an advantage. For you being there, people can easier integrate. They know more about your culture in general from the media, from the United States, from Hollywood. And so it's just a lot easier to integrate. At least that was my perception, right? And also just me navigating London myself. The fact that I didn't notice about myself, but I knew the tube lines by heart, because that's what we learned in primary school to learn English, right? They basically said, oh, tell me how to get from Piccadilly Circus to, I don't know, Victoria, and tell me what lines to use, right? So it kind of gave me a little reminder of how ever present the Anglo-Saxon world is.
Indeed, and the other side of that coin is also that I have found, but this is not based on statistical evidence, but I'm pretty convinced that if there are studies out there that they would say the same thing, that on average, British people have a greater interest or greater knowledge about the rest of the world as well, even though they are not very good with languages, right? Notoriously, English people struggle to learn a second language. There is much more information out there about how the rest of the world works, which might have its roots in the British Empire when Britain was everywhere and you needed to know a little bit about Southeast Asia, a little bit about the Americas, a little bit about Sub-Saharan Africa, etc. But I've always noticed this, whereas, for example, in a country like Spain, which is a country I love to live in, you notice that Spanish people are much less knowledgeable about the world, much less knowledgeable about what's going on outside of their own country.
And then the last observation I have about the UK is, I remember one of the central elements for Brexit voters was the over-regulation coming from the European continent, coming from Brussels. And I, during my time in the UK, I felt overly regulated by everything there, right? So the first observation I had here was in restaurants that at first I just thought, oh, this seems to be a very concerned waiter. They always ask you, but do you have any allergies? And I thought, no, thank you, but thanks for asking. After a few days, I thought, wait a second, why is every waiter overly concerned here? Then I asked one of them, and it turns out it's the law. Waiters and waitresses in the United Kingdom have to ask you, they legally are required to ask you whether you have any allergies. And I just thought, well, that's not very much focused on personal responsibility, is it? That to me feels like regulation that we do not have in the EU. Then there was another observation about a rental car we had, that whenever you would move across the street lines, right, it would give you a signal, an audible signal. And if you went above the speed limit, it also gave you a signal, right? And you couldn't turn it off. And so I jokingly called it a fascist car afterwards. And then the most concerning thing to me that I knew about the UK, but I was just surprised about the framing, was obviously cameras everywhere. And all the time, a quasi-insulting sign telling you that for your personal comfort and safety, we're recording every move you make. And I just thought to myself, I don't think I'm not comfortable with this. I'm not more comfortable that you film me while I'm having, right? So we were in a restaurant, in a private room, and that was recorded, right? It was just us. What is supposed to happen? The waiter is supposed to come and bring me bad food? Like, that's recorded, right? I mean, and so these three little things, I thought to myself, wait a second. The UK is not that freedom-loving country that I've always been told about.
Yeah, and I don't know to what extent British people still think of themselves as somehow freer than continental Europe. I'm not sure they do. I mean, certainly my wife doesn't, but I don't know if people in the UK perceive it like that. There is a real case to be made, and that depends on your philosophical leanings, that certainly pre-Trump, the United States had freedoms that continental Europe doesn't have in terms of constitutional rights, individual protections. But the UK has always been some kind of weird middle ground between that, right? Between continental Europe and the United States. This, what you're describing, is probably some kind of combination of not having a constitution, right? That's an important big deal. And having a very strong political, cultural, social elite that essentially imposes on the masses, on the plebs, if you like, rules and regulations that in other countries would never be accepted by the middle classes. But you've got this very incestuous network all coming down to Oxbridge, Cambridge and Oxford University, and maybe before that Eton and some other private public schools. And the word public and private school in the UK is always weird, right? Public schools being actually private and all that. But there is a very close-knit community of politicians, cultural leaders, intellectual leaders that all are leading media, that are leading political parties, that are leading economics, and that essentially take these steps to control the masses. And that is something that you don't see in continental Europe in the same way. It's very visible right now. I don't know if you've been following this, but already over the past decades, there has been this unearthing of how the police in the 20th century and early 21st century went after environmentalist groups in the UK. And it actually led to police infiltrating the most innocent kind of, you know, people just wanted to save some animals from animal cruelty and all that. But because that establishment perceives them as left-wing revolutionaries somehow, or somehow a danger to the well-being of the economic framework that's been built up, they infiltrated them with undercover policemen, who then got married to some of those activists, got children with those activists, and then left them to go to the next assignment and never to be heard of again. Horrible abuse that would never be acceptable in continental Europe. But in the UK, the establishment said, you know who we have to infiltrate and who we have to basically mess up? Those kinds of groups that want to protect animals. And tree-hugging, revolutionary, communist, Marxist, whatever they would have called them. And that is now there's now a commission looking into that into much detail, but the media has already published horrible stories about this. And so I don't think anyone can make a serious case that people in the UK are freer than in continental Europe. It just doesn't make any sense if you look at this reality.
I bet you it's the children of those weird marriages that are now throwing tomato sauce at paintings. obviously a joke. But overall, I really enjoyed my trip to the UK. So I hope that the listeners forgive me that I wasn't there for the last 2 weeks. And that maybe these insights make up for it.
Does this mean that you're now going to be more positive when we analyze Starmer's foreign policy or anything like that?
with foreign policy, 100% not. But I hope to at least understand the UK mindset a little bit better now, right? Because I'm pretty sure that in my analysis of the UK, there's always these 5 to 10% swinging around of like being a little bit, having at least a certain amount of schadenfreude about Brexit, right? But also maybe feeling left behind, right? Being like, oh, why do you leave me? Like, why do you leave my cool club of the EU? And just your typical German-UK rivalries, right? That whole thing of two world wars and one world cup, which is never-ending, childish, boring.
I always have to laugh about that because it's so stupid. It's so ridiculously stupid.
It is so stupid. And so you perceive yourself as the adult in the room, right? Because of that. But you're still slightly annoyed by it, I assume subconsciously in the end. So maybe those 10% that maybe kind of blind in my analysis of the UK, maybe they're down to 5% now. But lovely people. I mean, I would never wish anything bad upon the British. They make way too good tea for that. Wow. Oh, English breakfast tea, or as the Scottish call it, breakfast tea. That was the last little observation, right? Is how weird must it be to live in on the same island, but not in the same country, and like a part of your population really doesn't like the fact that you own them or rule them, right? You don't see many Union Jacks in Scotland, and all these little nitty gritty things, right? Of calling it breakfast tea, not serving English breakfast, but serving Scottish breakfast and throwing haggis into that. By the way, Scotland, you need some help. That's disgusting. But apart from that, very, very lovely experience.
Yeah, I'm glad to hear it. A tiny little bit of a factual correction there. You called it Union Jack. Union Jack is only when it's on a ship. Otherwise, we refer to it as Union Flag. I'm just saying that because I think everywhere around the world people call it Union Jack, but it only refers to it on the Navy.
Very interesting. I do not think anyone knows. That's one of those like things that's really cool to know at trivia night. who says that the Western Bubble podcast isn't also educational? All right. So speaking about education, but we unfortunately have to talk about Donald Trump again. He's making it really difficult for us not to. And Donald Trump is in a bit of a kerfuffle, let's call it that, with Harvard University, right? So I think we can safely say maybe the most prestigious university in the world, at least if you talk to people, I would say that they perceive it that way. And Trump picked a fight with them, already cut all the public funding to them for not getting rid of DEI policies and not changing university leadership to more align with his personal policies. And so yesterday, or I think the day before, for transparency, it is the 23rd of May when we're recording this. The Trump administration took away the license to host foreign students, which means that basically all 6,500 students, I think it was, who are currently enrolled at Harvard need to leave the university or transfer, and they're not allowed to take on any new foreign students.
Yeah, so the new contingent, the cohort that has been accepted for the 25-26 academic year now is in trouble. This is in the context of them already attempting to defund Harvard previously, and crucially, I would say, Colombia giving in to Trump, right, when it comes to the Palestinian protester. So there is a complex context here. If I were American, and I've said this already two or three times on this podcast, I would be freaking out about the future of my country. I really would. Because a government, a president using taxpayers' money to basically go after political enemies. I mean, I just, remind me, Dario, we've seen this somewhere before where this is kind of happening. It just reminds me of something, but I can't quite put my finger on it.
Right. I mean, I think neither of us wanted to call Trump a fascist in November, but I've seen this play out. Well, I didn't see it, but I know that this played out in 1933 Germany. Right? It's almost a really bad copy of what the Nazis did.
No, and exactly that, and I cannot emphasize this enough. I mean, I have never in my life used the word fascism to discuss Trump until now, until 2025. Because people use the word fascism as just, hey, they're too right-wing. You know how left-wing protesters call anyone who is slightly positive about capitalism, a fascist, and that kind of thing. So the word has lost a lot of its meaning. It's just, you know, like so many words are just being thrown around without any care. And I very purposely, not during his first term, not I've never used words. In fact, my argument was always about Trump. Look, he's not intellectual enough to be a fascist. In a sense, he has no ideology. It's just about his own narcissism. But now in 2025, and now with this with Harvard, you can see that at least the people around him do have a agenda much more clearly than during the first term. Trump himself is getting older. He always was a relatively simple man. He's getting simpler by the day. But the people around him are ear whisperers, and they are creating very, very scary fascist tendency in the United States, not just with respect to Harvard, not just defunding universities, going after enemies, but, and I'm sorry to make this maybe drastic comparison, but having their own brown shirts in ICE, with ICE going crazy in arresting immigrants, even European tourists, without any proper due process. Courts are overwhelmed. Courts can't deal with it. Courts are also being defunded, by the way. So you're creating a situation where all the power is centralized around the White House. And all I can say is good luck, America. You're going to need it.
I'm sorry. Luck won't be enough. You need... Well, actually, I don't know. It might be a future episode, but you need so many things at the same time to solve this. And I mean, we've talked about this in past episodes already, right? That they're kind of flooding the zone. And so because my real concern right now is that Harvard, or the next topic we will talk about, is the whole White House stunt, also just from 2 days ago, where the South African president was being shown off and basically paraded around in the Oval Office. And so you need a lot more things than that. What I'm worried about is that these two stunts are actually just stunts, right? And that there are some way more serious things going on in the background that they want to distract from. And so the United States needs a lot more than just luck.
Yeah. No, and the serious things going on in the background are the actual undermining of the judicial processes, legal processes, overwhelming the courts, basically making it impossible to anyone take a stand. And in the meantime, also starving the beast with the new bill, once again, public debt going up. The country is sliding down a hill, and the slide is accelerating. One thing that also reminds me of the 30s, well, again, reminds me, I wasn't there, but of what we know about the 30s, is the complete lack of opposition, how the Democratic Party is nowhere to be seen. Yeah, okay, AOC is holding some speeches, and Bernie Sanders and she have been touring and all that, but there is no political fight against this, exactly what you see in the 30s, where the opposition, well, first it wasn't the opposition, but the other parties are divided and doubting and don't really have a agenda, don't really have a clear narrative to sell to the people, and how just basic institutions, including the FBI, including the Justice Department, are rolling over and are okay with both the President and the Secretary of State and many others saying that the law doesn't apply to them, that they don't have to actually follow the Constitution, that they are above the law. It is so reminiscent of exactly what we know happened in the 1930s. And I almost hate the fact that we are making this comparison, because I've always been so critical of people making that comparison, saying, you know, don't abuse history for things that are not as bad, but now we're getting to a stage that it is that bad.
Absolutely. It's sorry to the listeners, right? It's just very frustrating to me, this conversation. The fact that we need to have it all the time. But I think that's at least for us, for two Europeans, it's the only thing we can do, right? Is kind of have this conversation, is point at it, and hopefully some Americans at some point feel inspired to take it to the streets.
Well, and I mean, from a very, I mean, look, this is bad news for everyone around the world. It's everyone should want the United States to do well, like we should want China to do well, we should want Russia to do well. It's never good news for anyone if a country as important as the United States goes down this path. From a more, if you like, practical, selfish perspective, if you care about Europe, I mean, you can see that a lot of intelligent Americans, including scientists, are actually starting to move towards Europe. There is certainly something positive there for Europe, but of course, that doesn't weigh up against the long-term damage that all of this is doing. And as you said, I just hope that Europe keeps its eyes open, and that just like with Brexit, where all of a sudden, it became clear that leaving the European Union was not a good idea, and in the Netherlands and Italy, that debate basically stopped. That if we now keep our eyes open towards the United States, that we make sure that we don't create a similar situation here.
Well, let's hope so. There's another thought I have. I mean, are we too critical on Trump by calling Trump a fascist and maybe not just the people around him? Because for Trump, isn't he just a corrupt fool or tool? Because I mean, it's very evident that I mean, I don't think Trump, as we saw in the first term, has the intellectual capacity to be a fascist. I think he's just very interested in his own personal wealth, in his family's wealth, right? You see this with the Boeing 747. I think it was the model that Qatar wants to send to the United States in exchange for whatever favor. Or I mean, even more openly corrupt, his whole cryptocurrency scam, right? Where basically, if you invest into his cryptocurrency, through which I think you made already 1.5 billion US dollars. If you do that, you kind of get special access. I mean, he's hosting this dinner for the top 100 investors into a cryptocurrency. And I also Eric and Trump Jr., right? They aren't the smartest tools in the toolbox. Isn't the Trump family just like a very useful fool tool for the likes of Stephen Miller and others who are the actual fascists in the White House?
That's exactly right, and that's exactly what I mentioned before, that I've always said you can't call Trump a fascist exactly because of what you're describing right now. He doesn't have an ideology. He doesn't care or know about these things. He's a narcissist, and I'm sorry to use psychological analysis without being his psychologist, but it's quite clear. It's about him, his own wealth, his own ego. He wants to be the man. He wants to be respected. He wants to be, all of those things are completely obvious. And that's also the difference between the first term and the second term. In the first term, he wasn't that much different, but the people around him and the institutions around him were different. Now the people, Stephen Miller has a much more important position now. The people that used to be sort of the adults in the room are all gone. And you've got the billionaires. By the way, once again, similar to businessmen and in Nazi Germany, you've got billionaires who see profitable opportunities here and who are also walking around with some kind of god complex, believing that they are the ones who can steer society in the right direction. So it is the surroundings, it's the environment that creates fascist dynamics. I would never ever call Trump himself a fascist. There's no evidence for that, but he is creating a fascist society.
Well, speaking about the billionaires who are surrounding Trump, I mean, so you have Elon Musk, you have Peter Thiel, right? Those kind of South African associated, at least, billionaires, and some others who appear to have planted the thought in Trump's head that there's a genocide against white farmers happening in South Africa. And that's the stunt I just referred to in the Oval Office just 2 days ago, where the South African president was sitting there. And again, right, you see this pathetic play where one of Trump's influencer journalists is asking a very clearly prepared question to the president of South Africa, about the genocide happening there, right? And he says there's no genocide happening. Trump stops him, interrupts him, tells him to shut up. They dim the lights, and suddenly a movie or some little film is appearing on a screen, and you basically see supposed evidence of white genocide in South Africa, of an opposition leader, basically, yeah, kind of calling for killing of white farmers. Yeah, like you have that, like those individuals doing that, And then you have basically graveyards, to which Trump constantly refers, to see these thousands of white crosses, of each of them being a white farmer killed by the supposed genocide, which is completely unfounded and wrong, right? So some of the evidence thrown together were like reports from the DRC on different elements. There is no genocide against white farmers, right? I do not in any space want any of our listeners to believe that this is happening just because we're talking about Trump's lies.
No, and just today or yesterday, one of the photographers of one of the pictures being used said this was a memorial. It wasn't even a graveyard. It was just a memorial. That there were all these little bits thrown together, exactly as you said, completely untrue, completely fabricated. Of course, there's no white genocide in South Africa. What there is happening is tension between still a dominant white economic minority versus a black majority that has been in political power for the past 30 years that actually still hasn't forgotten apartheid and still believes that there needs to be some readjustment. So it's not as if no tensions exist, but tensions is a completely different thing from genocide, obviously. This moment in the White House was somehow eerily reminiscent of the Zelensky Oval Office meeting. It was, as you said, clearly a setup. And that is the scary thing about these situations, that Trump has no clue about Ukraine. Trump has no clue about South Africa. But exactly as you said, people whisper in his ear. I mean, Musk is obviously an important influence, but also sort of the white supremacy groups that both Trump and others have been trying to please feel very comfortable with this idea of poor whites being somehow persecuted, because that fits the narrative of, racism against us poor white people. There was even this stunt of the 59 South Africans who were given asylum in the United States. I mean, it would be funny if it wasn't so serious, right? I mean, sorry. And Ramaphosa, to be fair to him, I think he dealt with it as well as he could. He was clearly prepared for something. I don't think he was prepared for this.
How do you prepare for this?
How do you prepare for this? I love that at some point that he said something along the lines of, I'm sorry, Mr. President, that I don't have a plane to give you. And then Trump, in his corrupt idiocy, answered, if you had a plane, I would accept it. Basically signaling to the world, I'm open for business. Just give me planes, give me wealth. I will be your friend. So I kind of appreciated the way Ramaphosa went about it. But of course, it was a ridiculous and horrifying moment once again. And it's those people who whisper in Trump's ear, the billionaires, the extreme ideologues. To some extent, there is some kind of evidence that these billionaires are also developing their own ideology, right? Thiel certainly, Musk is always a bit of a weird one, but Thiel and others around him, they really seem to believe that the future is them as a godsend, basically controlling American society and even controlling the world, because hey, they are the billionaires, so there must be something really special and really amazing about them, and they are sort of the philosopher kings who now need to run the United States. So there's this weird kind of combination of the billionaire delusion plus white supremacy happening, and those people are surrounding Trump, and that is leading to a situation that Baldur in 2025 calls the United States sliding as a country that is sliding towards fascism, which if you had told me this 5 years ago, I would have said you're crazy. I don't use fascism to describe these things.
I couldn't find a good transition from Trump to Eurovision, but I may have coined some absolutely outstanding terms while I was watching Eurovision about a week ago. Let's talk about the European Super Bowl or the European Electoral College, which I invite our listeners to look up why that would be the case. But as a quick reminder, right, so we are big fans of Eurovision, at least I am, and you, I think, watch it for secondhand entertainment, I think would be a fair assessment. We talked about it extensively last year, right? So for the listeners who don't know, Eurovision is this European music show where the European countries compete against each other. It's all funny, and there are some ridiculous songs that come out of it, and in the end there's one winner, and we have to listen to that song for the next 3 months. That's it, right? And last year we saw the State of Israel really politicizing, and their delegation really politicizing the show, right? So I encourage all the listeners to listen to our analysis about that from last year. Because last year Israel had very much lost a plot, I think is the expression we used, with regards to how aggressive they were, right? The delegation was and their candidate was. This year they had a different candidate. Their candidate actually was one of the very few survivors of that techno festival in the Israeli desert that was attacked on October 7th by Hamas. And the only way she survived is by kind of burying herself under the dead bodies of her friends and other attendees of that festival. So Israel, again, kind of had the sympathies of the European audience because I think they were either first or second place in the audience voting, right? So in the televoting. But at the same time, right, that kind of victory there is now being kind of turned into some form of approval of Israeli actions in Gaza, which I don't think is the case if you look at the responses of European policymakers that 1 year ago would never have doubted Israel and would have never said anything against it, and now are suddenly waking up to the fact that Israel has been starving Gaza, the state of Israel, right, the government of Israel has been starving Gaza for the last 2 months, and there are like millions. Well, I mean, those 2.2 million that are still left are at the verge of starving.
Yeah, and there are two issues here. The first is the reality in Gaza. The other one is the Israeli, if you like, marketing campaign, the way, the image that they want to portray to the rest of the world. And I don't think right now, certainly not in this episode, we need to discuss Gaza and what's going on. I mean, it's horrifying. There's no other word for it. I think it's just, you know, the pain and human suffering that we as humanity inflict upon ourselves, and in this case specifically the Israeli government inflicts upon the Palestinians. It's beyond words. But if you then look at simply from an Israeli perspective, okay, say there is this reality, we are doing, for whatever reason, we are doing what we're doing in Gaza and in the West Bank. Now, how do we connect to the rest of the world? How do we try to mitigate the damage out of this for ourselves, from our own selfish perspective? If you ask that question, the last thing you want to do is come across as aggressive, smug, arrogant, those kind of things. You want to say, look, we are poor victims of a terrorist attack. However, we do not in any way intend any unnecessary harm. We want to be friends with everyone. We connect to everyone. We are grateful to be here in Eurovision with all our friends. And let's make this festival, make Eurovision, a enjoyable evening that where everyone can just have their moment in the spotlight. Instead, not only does Israel have a very aggressive marketing campaign to make people vote for them, which is completely counterproductive. I'm not sure if it is some kind of trolling, like, hey, look at what we can do with our sophisticated technology and our influence, or whether it's actually the belief that if they come second or first in the Eurovision, that Europeans think, oh, look, we love Israel again, everything's going to be fine. But it works incredibly counterproductively. And also, to a certain extent, the choice to make this singer the delegate is, of course, completely misjudged in today's scenario, right? Because if Israel had moved on and wasn't bombing Gaza, then maybe people would be very happy to, okay, look, you're a brave woman, you survived this horrific terrorist attack, we appreciate it. But that's not the case. Israel is in the middle of a military campaign. And therefore, that woman is now a propaganda prop. And not just that, the lyrics of the song, I mean, I can't remember all of them, I didn't memorize them, my apologies, but they go along the lines of, there will be a new dawn, life will go on. Well, that is kind of unfortunate to sing that at a time that you're killing thousands of Palestinian children, right? That's probably not the right moment to make that statement. So from her personal perspective, from the perspective of a young woman who's gone through this horrifying experience, I can't even begin to imagine how horrifying it must have been for her, to be a person that could inspire others, great, I've got no problem with that, that makes a lot of sense, but not at Eurovision during a time that the Israeli military is abusing its power. It just doesn't work. And the result is, and I never thought that this would happen, because I've grown up in the Netherlands, which is a country that is hypersensitive about anti-Semitism, that is hypersensitive about criticizing Israel. I can't believe that we're now at a stage where the Netherlands is actually actively criticizing Israel and boycotting Israel. I think it's a good thing. It needs to happen. As a Dutch citizen, I'm happy that my government is doing that. But it shows the complete failure of Israeli propaganda or marketing.
And there's another country that also has been attending Eurovision for years, has been rather successful in the last 3 years, particularly because of certain sympathy points, right? And that's Ukraine, because of the Russian invasion. And Ukraine did fine at this year's Eurovision. I think they actually toned it down. I think they realized that maybe last year they went a little bit too far with that. But in the meantime, right, while Ukraine is not kind of doing the Israeli play at Eurovision, at least not to that extent, they are assassinating or allegedly assassinating people in Madrid, for an example.
Yeah, I mean, we don't have hard evidence that it was Ukraine, but it seems very likely, to put it like that. A pro-Russian Ukrainian advisor who lived in Madrid, who was sold by Ukraine for corruption charges and those kinds of things, but lived in Madrid with his family, just having, I think, brought his children to school or picking them up, was assassinated in the street. Now, Ukraine has been doing this with Russian politicians, military members, and arguably, we still don't know the answer, but it's still very likely and possible that Ukraine had something to do with Nord Stream 2. The Ukraine is engaging in this campaign of basically asymmetric warfare, but I don't understand what they're trying to get out of that. Sure, you can kill a Russian military general. Sure, you can kill a pro-Russian advisor in Madrid. Of course you can do that. And how does that actually help you? I do know how it hurts you, because Spain is now furious about this, right? Spain is saying, hang on, we don't want any assassination on our soil. We don't want any force. Just like India assassinating people in Canada, that led to this enormous row. If you're Ukraine, just like if you're Israel, and by the way, the same would apply to Russia, always when you're in a situation of war, of violence, what you need to try to do is be seen as the kind, pleasant person that people or country that people can relate to. You need to be likable. You need to be making friends so that they continue to support you. By assassinating people, what you're doing is you're making yourself look bad. You're making yourself look like a criminal. And it's completely counterproductive. So I honestly don't think that even without that negative backlash that of course you're going to get, assassinating people is not good. I honestly don't think that you're going to get anything out of it. Who cares about some Russian general? Who cares about some corrupt official in Madrid? They're replaceable. They are not relevant. The relevant thing is happening at the front and how much financial and military support you get from European countries. So please, Ukraine, do not annoy unnecessarily these Europeans by doing this kind of nonsense.
This episode appears to be all about learning the lessons, right, from other countries, from other case studies, other examples. And there actually have been quite a few elections in the past, happening in the past 2 weeks and months. And that's going to be the focus of our next episode, unless something crazy happens, right? In today's world, I want to be careful about making plans for next week's episode because, I don't know, Trump just dropped a 50% tariff on the European Union. Who knows what will happen in the next few days. But there have been elections happening in Canada, Australia, Poland, Romania, and Portugal. So those are the ones within the West. And the outcomes of them have actually been quite interesting. And it does appear like that at least certain Western countries are kind of taking the lessons from what happens if you vote for a Trump type of person. Because they've been voting against those candidates. And so that will be the episode of next week. And I think this was today was a nice update episode to kind of get back into the groove. I think we covered a lot of elements. And then This really seems like a great moment to end today's conversation. If you have any questions, comments, or you had a mistake that we've made throughout the episode, please make sure to send us an email to thewesternbubble@gmail.com, and we will try to incorporate them into our following episodes. Thank you very much to the listeners for joining us today. Make sure to join us again next week when we burst the Western bubble. That is it from my side. Balder, how many quotes do you bring for us today?
Well, let me start a quote from only one person, but indeed multiple quotes. If it were up to me, we should have some episodes where we just read letters from the US founding fathers, these white men, but being a white man doesn't mean that you can't have really good ideas. These intellectual white men who basically were at the foundation of probably the most successful country that history has ever known. If you look at the United States in the 20th century, in terms of both technological, intellectual, and economic progress, who set up this amazing project with certain flaws, they knew the weaknesses that were on the horizon for the project that they were setting up. And we've discussed this in other episodes. I've even used one of these quotes already in the past. It's by John Adams. One day we're just going to read out John Adams's works just for the Americans to remember what their founding fathers thought. But I collected a few quotes for now that basically should be a warning sign, or were a warning sign at the time, and should now be a very scary reminder for anyone who cares about US well-being. Remember, democracy never lasts long. It soon wastes, exhausts, and murders itself. There never was a democracy yet that did not commit suicide. There is a danger from all men. The only maxim of a free government ought to be to trust no man living with power to endanger the public liberty. Children should be educated and instructed in the principles of freedom. And liberty, once lost, is lost forever.